Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Sitterick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, as Senator Elizabeth Warren rolls out her policy proposals, some are wondering whether the specifics even matter anymore.
It's a painful truth to recognize that policy is less important than we would like to think it is. We are increasingly seeing that political brands matter more than policy platforms.
Our Week in Review panel reflects on that, as well as the latest developments from Patriots owner Robert Kraft. Also today, the racial politics of photography is the subject of a new book about the abolition movement. And female friendship, self-love, and body positivity in A.D. Bryant's new show, Shrill.
It's about someone who has always felt that they're too big to live in a world that wants them to be smaller, and she's decided to take up space.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. It's Friday, so let's get right to our Week in Review. As WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks reported earlier this week, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is dominating the 2020 presidential primary policy debate. This week, she's proposed some big changes in how we elect our presidents.
We can have national voting, and that means get rid of the Electoral College and everybody.
And how to heal America's legacy of slavery.
I believe it's time to start the national, full-blown conversation about reparations in this country.
Compare that to Texas's Beto O'Rourke, who raised more than $6 million in his first 24 hours and who's offered very little in terms of specific policy. Richard Reeves, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, told Brooks policy ideas might not matter.
It's a painful truth to recognize that policy is less important than we would like to think it is. We are increasingly seeing that political brands matter more than policy platforms.
Others, like Bill Curry, political writer and former policy advisor to Bill Clinton, argue for substance over style.
It's easier to get on a skateboard and have a photo taken in March of the year before, but I don't think that's what voters carry into a caucus.
For more, we turn now to our Week in Review panel. And joining me now in studio is Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor Renee Graham. Renee, great to see you again.
Hi, Chris.
And also with us is Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Good to see you too again,
Thanks,
Joe.
Chris.
So let's jump right in there. Does policy still matter to voters in 2020, do you think?
Maybe it doesn't matter in March of 2019, but a year from now, it's going to matter and may matter even sooner than that. It's odd. I think at this moment, people are still sort of testing the waters. They're sort of seeing who these candidates are, what they have to say, what they stand for. I think it's really easy for people to get caught up on the fact that, hey, look, he's standing on a table and he's talking to people, but maybe they're not really zeroed in on policy at this point. So I'm not terribly worried yet.
Joe, what do you think? Do details matter?
Yeah, I think voters do care about policy. I think the fact that you're seeing some success by other candidates like the South Bend mayor, Pete Buttigieg, I think I said his name right. But, he's presented some pretty detailed policy positions, and he's getting a lot of traction, as opposed to Elizabeth Warren, who doesn't seem to be getting the same kind of traction, at this time with progressives. And so I think it's more of a function of her not being able to get out of the gates fast than voters not listening to policy.
What do you mean by get out of the gates? She was one of the first to jump in.
Well, she got out fast, but she's stalled. She should be doing much better in New Hampshire right now. She should be doing much better in Iowa. And she obviously has been hampered, I think, by the whole Native American controversy. She never really shook that. So I think it's going to take a lot to get her going. But I think, this is why she's trying gimmicks like getting rid of the Electoral College, which she knows is not possible. But it's obviously a good thing, a good talking point, and a good litmus test for progressive voters.
All right, Renee, I saw that face.
I don't think that getting rid of something that's a remnant of slavery is a gimmick. I think it's an important conversation people need to be having, you know, not just because of what happened in 2016, but because of what happened in 2000. And the bottom line is that you're talking about the Electoral College that, you know, from that we got, you know, the 3/5 compromise of black people being counted as 3/5 of a person. That still exists in terms of the Electoral College. Like, why are we still having? So that's not a gimmick. I think it's an important conversation to be having, especially as we're going into another general election.
Well, I meant the gimmick because you need 3/4 of the states to ratify it in order to get it passed, unless you do this thing like a compact. That's why it's not going to happen, and Warren knows it's not going to happen. But it's a good thing to throw out there.
Well,
But I think there, you know, I think Marty Walsh hit on the right idea. He think, you know, now is not the greatest time to be talking about changing our Constitution in the context of a presidential campaign, because obviously it's going to benefit politically certain candidates by getting rid of the Electoral College. And that's why people like Elizabeth Warren are doing it.
So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on her raising some of these issues, because regardless of whether this helps her politically or not, she's talking about some pretty big issues in terms of electoral fairness, dealing with this country's history in terms of race and slavery. Is there a benefit to having these conversations, even if it's not necessarily to promote her specific policy or her political brand? Do you think that there is some good that can come out of having the conversation?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's better than standing on tables and pretending you're Bobby Kennedy. You know, so I'd rather much see somebody talking like Elizabeth Warren than doing that.
More policy, less furniture standing on. That's what I'm looking for at this point.
Yeah, that's 2019 in a nutshell. So I did mention O'Rourke, and we're alluding to him here. $6 million in the first 24 hours of his campaign. That's even more than Bernie Sanders in his first day. Warren raised a fraction of that in her first 24 hours, just short of $300,000. Why is it that O'Rourke has connected, do you think, with so many voters?
I'm not really sure. That's a good question. I mean, he's not particularly experienced. He doesn't have, like we just discussed, he doesn't have the greatest policy ideas out there. He's obviously an attractive candidate, and, you know, he has some personality to him. But beyond that, I don't quite see the attraction. I think it's probably going to be short-lived.
Renee, what do you think?
I think he still has that new car smell a little bit for people. I think he's still unknown. I think he made a big splash, obviously, last fall when he ran for the Senate against Ted Cruz and did very well, much better than people would have expected. So I think there's a curiosity about him, but at some point that has to turn into something else. So, I mean, right now, I guess it looks good, and he's like, you know, got this punk rocker background. He was a hacker, and there's all these things that people are sort of glomming onto. But at some point, they're going to have to see if there's any substance behind it all.
Yeah, it's interesting. Nate Silver from 538 worked out that Sanders and O'Rourke had the most press coverage around their announcements. I think you can kind of see that with Sanders. He ran a pretty formidable campaign in 2016. But for O'Rourke, who doesn't have that kind of experience, I'm wondering, do you think that there is a gender issue here in how we cover these candidates?
Yes, I do. You've got Sanders out there. And who came from 2016, you've got Beto O'Rourke, and they're getting a lot of the headlines right now. And you'd forget that there's actually women running in this campaign right now, and you're not hearing anything about them, including Warren, who is trying to, who's talking about Facebook and talking about reparations. What's going on there? Why is that happening? Why are we hearing so little about the many women who are in this campaign?
I disagree a little bit. I do think we're hearing some about the women candidates. Certainly Kamala Harris got a tremendous splash when she entered the race. Elizabeth Warren herself got a big splash when she was the first one to get in the race, too. It maybe has worn off since then. But I think certainly Kamala Harris has gotten a lot of attention, and she drew 20,000 people to her announcement. So it's not like, and I think even people like Amy Klobuchar are getting a little traction, at least in the Midwest.
So I want to play one more cut from Bill Curry, again, political writer, former policy advisor to Bill Clinton. You mentioned that this is very early in the 2020 campaign, which obviously it is. But he says that there is a benefit for Warren kind of laying out all of these policy proposals early on.
You can't call her a socialist when she deals with the label directly and then puts on a multi-page accountable capitalism proposal. You can't accuse her of lack of specificity when everything she says, she tells you how she's going to pay for it.
So do you think that there is something to be gained here by basically trying to drive the narrative yourself?
I do. I mean, you know, I think that's what has been happening with Mayor Pete. I'm not going to attempt to pronounce his last name because I'll botch it. But that's what's been happening with Mayor Pete, this idea of policy. Now, I think there's still the issue where he's being taken more seriously in some of the things he's saying and getting a lot of traction in a way that Warren isn't. You know, do I think there's a little bit of sexism in this? Of course I do. But I think there's also going to be a point, as I've said, where people are going to want to hear specifics. And Warren right now is already doing that.
It's a good niche for her, too, to say, I'm the one with specific policies as opposed to other candidates. And I think it's going to bode well in the long run if she gets but she still has to start doing better, I think, in places like New Hampshire.
Interesting that having actual concrete ideas now makes you that's your niche.
But, yeah.
Joe, I know the Electoral College thing is something that you called pandering in a column for the Boston Herald. Is it just the fact that you think this can't happen, or do you think there's no legitimacy to the argument of getting rid
of
it?
No, I think there's definitely an argument. There's certainly a conversation to be had, but as a realistic from a practical point of view, needing 3/4 of the states, that's not going to happen. I think a much better idea for people to focus on if they want to change it is to do like states like Maine have and not do a winner-take-all delegate selection Electoral College selection. So in that way, you don't necessarily win all your votes. You can apportion them out by congressional district, and that gives you a little more leeway, I think. And if you want to change things, that might be a better way to do it.
Renee, what do you think?
I think you have to start the conversation. You know, I can remember when same-sex marriage was a pipe dream. And everyone said, well, why are we talking about that? It's never going to happen. You have to have the conversation, and you have to have it in a serious way.
Yeah. Speaking of that, as we mentioned, Warren's also suggesting reparations. She's not the only candidate to mention that. What do you make of that? Is that a serious proposal? And do you think that conversation will continue as the election moves closer?
You know, I think it's been banging around for the last few years. Obviously, when Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote his piece for The Atlantic, The Case for Reparations, it's been a continuing idea that's been out there for candidates to start talking about it. And it's forcing people to get on the record about it, to say, yes, I believe there need to be some kind of reparations. Again, does it mean it's going to happen tomorrow? Does it mean that all the finances have been worked out? No. But I think it's you have to start these conversations somewhere.
Joe, yeah, and I don't think Elizabeth Warren has been specific about how to pay for that either. You know, if you're going to talk about that, you should talk about how you're going to pay for it as well. And her ultra-millionaire tax isn't going to pay for everything that she's proposing. She's proposing hundreds of billions of dollars in new spending.
I don't know. You could stop building that wall in Mexico. Maybe that would help.
Well, you speak of the wall. I think, obviously, the elephant in the room as we're talking about 2020 is President Trump. He has changed kind of the way we talk about policy and elections. Again, Richard Reeves, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, basically says that it took all the nuance out of it and makes it down to a yes or no question.
What Donald Trump did during the campaign was to just paint in a very, very broad brush indeed. Perhaps most obviously the wall, rather than having a debate about immigration policy in the round, what you have is, are you for or against the wall? Are you for or against the Muslim ban?
So there's an argument to be made that that approach worked. How would you respond to that?
Joe?
Oh, well, I would say that, you know, it's obviously a good thing to talk about, but I'm not sure if it's really going to get you anywhere for the Democratic candidates anywhere, because Democratic voters are looking for something totally different, I think, than Trump voters are. You know, talking about the wall, yes or no, but they're looking for more specific policy on what your immigration policy is. Maybe it might be an advantage to do it, but I don't think so in the Democratic primary.
All right, interesting. We're going to shift gears and move to another story. That is New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft. He's fighting to block the release of a surveillance video connected to charges of solicitation of prostitution. Kraft also rejected a plea deal offered by Florida prosecutors earlier this week. Sticking point, as part of that deal, Kraft would have had to admit that he would have been found guilty in court. Some actually felt that the deal that was offered was too lenient on Kraft and the other Johns who received it.
We're starting to see a recognition that this is harmful because it's rooted in inequality, and that, in fact, the accountability for that harm should rest with the buyer.
And there has been some public fallout. For example, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey said he'll be returning campaign contributions from Kraft.
I feel that it's appropriate for me to return those campaign contributions.
Defense attorney Jordan Wagner, who represents Kraft and 15 of the other men who are charged in the case, told WBZ that despite the public outcry, Kraft has a legitimate case here.
We have to see if the videos were obtained properly. And secondly, I would dispute the notion that it was an exchange of money for sex. I don't know if there's any evidence of actual solicitation of prostitution.
All right. So I want to start with the plea deal that Kraft ultimately ended up turning down. As I mentioned, he would have had to admit that he would have been found guilty in court, would have had to perform community service, pay a fine, fulfill an education requirement. That deal was offered to others as well who may still accept it. We spoke on Radio Boston with Nikki Bell, founder and director of Living in Freedom Together, or LIFT, which supports survivors of commercial sex exploitation and trafficking in Worcester. She said that the deal didn't go far enough.
For me, it's difficult to say, like, this is justice. I mean, you know, the women that I work with, and including myself, were incarcerated and served, you know, a lot of time for prostitution-related activities. And, you know, sometimes it feels like it's a slap on the wrist.
So, Renee, I'll start with you. Before we get to Kraft's decision to turn down the deal, what did you make of the offer that was made?
You know, I thought the offer was fair. You know, I think what's surprising to me is, you know, I thought the whole point of having a lot of money was to be able to buy your way out of these sorts of things. And I guess Robert Kraft is going to do that. He's just going to do it in a very different way by trying to fight it. I'm not surprised he didn't take the deal, though, because he has no intention of admitting guilt. And he would have had to at least admit that there would have been enough evidence for him to be called to be found guilty. So I'm not surprised he didn't do it, but I thought the deal was fair.
Joe, what about you?
Yeah, you don't hire those high-priced lawyers to take the first deal that comes along. But I do think it was a fair charge, and it was a fairly tough one, in fact, solicitation. They could have charged him with just a simple misdemeanor, and that would have been much less of a penalty. So I think they were trying to make an example of Mr. Kraft in this case. You know, whether ultimately the price he pays, I'm not sure. I think he has paid the price already in some sense, and a damage to his public image has been tremendous, obviously, and we still don't know what the NFL is going to say about this, too. He could get a very severe penalty from the NFL.
Well, so let me ask you then, what do you think the NFL should do in this case? It's interesting. I think we're kind of in uncharted territory here.
I think if you look at what they've done to other owners, you know, I think suspending him from games is certainly on the table. I don't think taking away the ownership of the team is on the table. I think that is probably is going to be too strong for the NFL. But I do think they likely will at least suspend him for 5 or 6 games.
Renee, what do you think?
I agree with Joe. I think he'll be suspended. I think he'll get a fine. I think the idea of stripping ownership is it's not going to happen. I just don't even see it as a possibility. Roger Goodell, you know, also doesn't necessarily have the best record of dealing with serious issues that crop up amongst NFL owners and players. So I'm not terribly worried about Robert Kraft being treated roughly.
Yeah, I'm not worried that he's going to be treated roughly, but I think it will be interesting to see. The NFL, I think, knows that they have received a lot of criticism for the way they've dealt with some of these issues in the past.
But they won't. I don't think they'll make an example of Robert Kraft with this.
Yeah. I'm wondering, from the Patriots' point of view, do you think that the team will feel that any actions are necessary in terms of maybe elevating Jonathan Kraft and saying, okay, thanks, Bob. See ya.
I don't see that happening.
Yeah, I don't see that happening. I do think it's possible that it could expedite his retirement at some point, but not right now. He's certainly not going to take a bow right now. And he's not even admitting any guilt at all. I mean, so I think he could have easily taken the route at the beginning of this, saying, I'm very sorry what happened, it shouldn't have happened, and taken his punishment. But he's obviously chosen to fight it.
So Mark Leibovich, who is the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, wrote a book about the NFL, spent a lot of time following around owners, attending meetings. And he actually thinks that because of some of these past missteps by the league, that Roger Goodell is going to go above and beyond to take these matters seriously.
The NFL, from the Ray Rice incident a few years ago to a number of really high-profile things that have transpired in the last year, has really struggled to sort of get in front of issues of importance to women. And look, the NFL, their fastest-growing block of potential fans are women, and they can't afford to alienate them.
So that interview and that great percussion beat from NBC Sports, what do you make of the NFL's position here? Do you think it's important? Do they stand to lose any fans based on the way they handle this situation?
I don't. I mean, I don't know that there was a great dip in viewership after the Ray Rice debacle and the way that Roger Goodell handled that. And this, you know, on the surface is much less serious than what Ray Rice did. So I don't really see Roger Goodell feeling the need that, oh, my God, you know, our big fan base is women and we need to do something about that. I'm just not convinced that the penalties are going to be that severe.
The fans already hate the Patriots anyway. So, you know, I think it's likely that there's going to be a fairly severe penalty against Mr. Kraft. And by fairly severe, I mean 6 games or something like that. And that to him, that's a big deal. To Kraft, that's a big deal because that's his thing, is to go to these games, to sit in the box, get his TV time. You know, if he gets stripped of that, I think, you know, that would be a big blow to him.
Even that just feels like a strange punishment. Like, oh, now you can't sit in the owner's box for 6 games. Like, what is that? I don't even know. That's a punishment? I don't know. It's, yeah,
but
it's
what do they do? I mean,
that's right. He's an owner. There's not a lot they can do. It's not like he's a running back and they can keep him off the field. It's right. Not, you know, so they'll do what they can do, but it's not going to amount to much.
I do think the season opener where they have the banner raising, that probably means a lot to Kraft. Other than that, I'm not sure how much he cares about whether or not he's in the stadium for those games. In all of the public outcry, one person who hasn't really distanced himself from Robert Kraft is President Trump. President Trump said specifically he wants Robert Kraft to accompany the Patriots on their trip to the White House for the Super Bowl celebration. Richard Levick was talking on CNN and said that basically makes total sense, and the optics aren't going to hurt President Trump here.
He looks at this and says, what do I do? Do I gain 2-3 votes from disinviting him? But what I do is I reaffirm my base when I stand by my friends.
So what do you think? Anything to make of Trump kind of doubling
down
on that?
I'm not sure if it's reaffirming his base, but I do think that it's reaffirming his friendship with Kraft. And, you know, Kraft could have easily distanced himself from the president at some point, but he didn't. He stood by Trump. So I think now he's just doing a turn for Kraft.
All right. I want to make sure we leave time for our hubbubs, the brief stories or events that caught your attention this week. Renee, love to start with you.
This weekend, continuation of the 21st annual Boston Underground Film Festival. It is wonderful. It started Wednesday. It will be going through Sunday at the Brattle Theater. You know, crazy, weird, cool, quirky films from around the world. And people should definitely check it out because it's going to be better what they'll see at their big multiplex. And you get out there and support small filmmakers.
Brattle's great, too. I love
Absolutely.
It there.
My hubbub is more of a prediction that somebody at TD Bank is going to be fired, or if they haven't, they have already been fired for that idiotic sign that they put out that said, you know, if you lived it, you may be in downtown Boston right now, but your phone might be in Dorchester. You know, really stupid. The mayor is, you know, insulting the mayor's hometown. Not a good move.
Well, and such a racist dog whistle there. I mean, it's hard to imagine that went through multiple levels of the.
Samsung did a similar thing years ago.
Yeah.
You know, just a couple of years ago, where they were talking about your wallet being missing in Mattapan. It's just like, oh wow, like. Nobody learned any lessons from that at all, did they?
Around and around we go. All right, my hubbub is a little bit on the lighter side. We are in the midst of my favorite 4 days of the sports calendar. That is March Madness, obviously. For me, there is nothing better than the purity of this tournament. And I know the NCAA has plenty of issues that we can talk about another day for sure. But when you really get down to it, there are so many great storylines that happen in this tournament, whether it's individual performances. You had Ja Morant for Murray State, 12-seeded Murray State beating 5th-seed Marquette. He puts up a triple-double. It's the first triple-double in the NCAA since 2012, the 9th since they started tracking him. So you get incredible individual performances. You get great team performances. You get record-setting performances. Fletcher McGee for Wofford. Who's heard of Wofford before this tournament, right? Sets a record for the most career three-pointers. Hit 7 in the game yesterday. They now could potentially upset a 2-seed in Kentucky. You've got close games, nail biters. Auburn and New Mexico State came down 78-77. But really, it's all about the purity of the game and athletes that aren't getting paid millions of dollars to do it. They're there. 90% of them aren't going pro. They love what they do, and it shows in the way they play. So I love this tournament. Hope everybody enjoys it as much as I do. And I just want to thank Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe, WBUR contributor. Thank you so much, Renee.
Thank you, Chris.
And Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Chris.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Sitterk. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterk. We're going to spend some time talking about the young girl who became the poster child, literally, for the anti-slavery movement. Mary Mildred Williams was only 7 years old when her father managed to purchase her freedom along with that of the rest of her family. He did it with the help of abolitionists in Boston, and when those anti-slavery leaders saw little Mary, they decided that hers was the face that would win over other whites to their cause. They took a daguerreotype, a kind of photograph, of Mary in 1855 and published it widely. Photographer Jesse Morgan Owens stumbled upon the image and went on to discover Mary's story, and with it, a key but partly obscured chapter of the abolition movement. Her book is called Girl in Black and White, and Jesse Morgan Owens is in our studio now. Jesse, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Chris.
So radio, obviously, not a visual medium, so we're talking about a picture here. Our picture is up at the website, radioboston.org. But for the listeners, could you describe the image that we're talking about?
Absolutely. So it's a daguerreotype of a little girl. She's 7 years old. She had reddish brown hair, and so it appears to be brownish sepia colored in the photograph. And she's wearing a beautiful plaid dress with lace. And she's sitting with her elbow on a notepad. It was made by Julian Vanerson as a daguerreotype in 1855. And Vanerson photographed mostly senators, home presidential hopefuls in Washington, D.C. So it's a very classy portrait. It's held at the Massachusetts Historical Society, and Mary Nell Mitchell found it a couple of years ago.
All right. And so we're talking about a picture that maybe looks like a white girl, but is actually a young black girl.
Yes.
We're going to get into that. But before we do, I'd love it if you could set the stage for us a little bit. Talk a little bit about her family, how they gained their freedom, and how the connection to Boston was made.
Okay, great. Yes. So Mary is the fourth generation of her family that was sexually enslaved in Virginia. She was born in 1847 in Prince William County, Virginia. And her grandmother, Prudence Bell, was the slave of a woman named Constance Cornwell and her grandson, who was actually half black. And so what happened was that Prudence got caught up in a court case in which John, this young black man, was trying to claim his property, which was hard to do in Virginia in the 1850s. And her father, Mary's father, the little girl in the photograph, had escaped slavery from Stafford County, Virginia, to Boston, and ended up on Joy Street in Boston, where he met a number of members of the Vigilance Committee through his job at Cornhill Coffee House. The slave catchers came for him, too, and he ran away and hid out with Henry David Thoreau, which is one of my favorite chapters in the book. And then he made it back to Boston, where he fundraised to try and free his family. And because he was a person who was, a fugitive from slavery, he couldn't give the check directly to his master, who right. also was his dad. He had to use intermediaries, and one of the intermediaries who was the most available at the time was Charles Sumner, who had just gone to Washington to serve in the Senate. And so that's when Senator Charles Sumner met Mary, was after he had, made the manumission happen and handed over the money to the appropriate parties. Here comes this family into his life. And actually, at first, Sumner thought the brother was the most interesting person in the story. He really loved Mary's older brother, Oscar. But Oscar presents as black. He's a darker-skinned young man, and he was about 10 years old at the time. And Sumner thought Mary would be a more compelling argument for anti-slavery.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about that.
So it's about the same time that a number of sort of novels and so forth about white slave propaganda are coming through. There's a lot of sympathetic characters in the anti-slavery movement that are white, from Uncle Tom's Cabin to The White Slave. There's a play on Broadway at this time and a novel called Ida May, which is about a five-year-old who gets kidnapped and sold into slavery, who's a white child. And so people were thinking about the fugitive slave law as potentially threatening all children. And I think it was an interesting move on Sumner's part to decide, you know what, I'm going to send this picture up to the state legislature of Boston, which at that time was largely nativist, and say, you think that white people deserve this certain kind of treatment or privilege. What are you going to do with a person who looks like Mary?
You call this image of Mary one of the first images of photographic propaganda. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So as a photographer, I know that photography is political. I decide to take a picture because it's what I want you to see. And I want you to see it exactly the way that I see it, exactly at the time that I saw it, and the way that I want to see it. And I think that back in the 1840s, people didn't necessarily, well, historians took a long time to get to an understanding that people were using photography in a similarly political way at that time. So he saw the photograph, or he had the photograph made in order to make a political point. It's largely a propaganda photograph. It's a portrait of a little girl that's intended to make an argument.
Yeah, I'm as a reader, there's kind of a very unsettling feeling about this whole story because on one hand, you're talking about the abolition movement, so obviously major milestone in terms of social progress.
Mm-hmm.
On the other, you're seeing Mary's image being used, and it just kind of raises some troubling questions, I think, about the motivations and sympathies of the people
mm-hmm.
that the picture is speaking to.
Sure.
Did you kind of feel that pull and tug as you're telling
Absolutely.
The story?
Absolutely, yeah. And you can't decide to write about abolitionist literature and not be just a little bit in love with the abolitionists. And like as a white progressive woman, I saw them as sort of heroes, you know, when I first started the project. But as I got to know them, you know, I saw even though they were willing to put their lives on the line, literally ramming down doors, putting themselves in danger, or, you know, their livelihoods on the line in terms of, you know, Senator Seward. I feel like those folks were really trying to do their best, but yet still harbored a great deal of prejudice and bias. And it comes up in their language. It comes up in the way that they speak about Mary and her family as poor creatures.
Right.
Lots of white saviorism is happening here. And, you know, the whole argument is based around an idea that there are people who don't look like slaves and they are white people. And I think these white people making this argument to other white people is a part of the problem. And as I got closer to the story and I spent more time with it, I felt like it had a lot of lessons for us today about poster children in general and like how arguments are presented to us as an audience.
Yeah, I'm reminded we had a conversation last week talking about the women's suffrage movement.
Right.
And again, a social cause that I think we all look back on and say that was a great step forward. But also when you look at the characters involved, some serious flaws in that case, also racism.
Yes.
And it just kind of puts into context some of those the heroes from the past, I think, that we read about.
What we do when we write history is we look at what people have left as written records and we make the stories for them. And a lot of times they're pretty flattering. And the 19th century is a pretty tattered history. We don't know a lot about everybody who was like what their ideas were about race and gender. So absolutely. And I think with the women, you know, with the women's suffrage movement, a lot of the racism that was happening there was happening everywhere. It just wasn't recorded because it wasn't considered to be the important part of the story. And now we're starting to get to a sense where we're like, you know, allies today, people today need to know what it really means to be, you know, truly progressive hero.
Yeah. Obviously, this image became widely distributed. What happened to Mary and her family kind of once that fervor subsides?
Well, I don't want to give up too much of the book because I'd like everybody to buy it.
Of course.
But I will say that, you know, she was only in the public eye for about 3 months and her family kind of retrieved her from it. She did show up at Everett School here in Boston as, you know, the liberator mentioned that, oh, there's this girl that Sumner saved at this school, so it must be a great school. And then she falls out of the public eye. She lived here in Boston the rest of her life, more or less, with the exception of the last 10 years, in Hyde Park, on Chestnut Street and Beacon Hill. She worked as a clerk of court, and she largely passed as a white woman for her adulthood. Once all of her family members had passed and she was on her own, that was probably the best way for her to support herself. So she lived, I think, a pretty quiet life, in part because she was, you know, not she was kind of closeted in a way. She couldn't be herself in the same way that we would expect today. And
right.
So she had to kind of run a gauntlet of staying in a private life. And Thomas Wentworth Higginson, for example, mentions meeting her, seeing her at the courthouse. And he's like, I didn't talk to her because I didn't want to give her up and let her, you know, let everybody know who she was.
No.
So we know that this was probably not an easy life, but it was, I think, you know, she didn't stay in the public eye for long because I believe her family truly loved her and wanted her to have a healthy childhood.
I think it's really interesting as we're looking back at other images from that time. Mary, 7-year-old, obviously had very little say over kind of how her image was used. But compare that to someone like Frederick Douglass, who became the most photographed American man of the 19th century. It's almost impossible, except for one notable exception, to find an image of him smiling.
Yeah.
As Harvard professor John Stauffer told NPR's Michelle Martin, that's not by accident.
the smiling black was to play into the racist caricature. And his cause of ending slavery and ending racism had the gravity that required a stern look.
Also kind of always finely dressed in suits and that very serious look. As a photographer, what strikes you about the Frederick Douglass images?
Oh, I love them. And I think the part of it is that he's using the medium in such a smart way. He understands that there's power in ubiquity. And that's why there's so many of them. He understands if people just keep seeing images look like this, then that would change their minds over time. That he doesn't, you don't know what's going to change someone's mind, but surely ubiquity has something to do with it.
I was also reading about another abolition leader, Sojourner Truth, who famously used photography to help end slavery. And it was interesting. So photographers at the time basically had sole rights to the images they took.
Right.
And she kind of countered that by adding her slogan to her picture cards, which was, "I sell the shadow to support the substance,"
yeah.
which I just thought was a great line.
Right.
What is it about photography that has such power, do you think?
Oh, that's a great question. I think it has the power to show us as an act of vision what the world could look like. And so when we pose a photograph or we even put some nice filters on a photograph that we've made, we're showing the world as we wish it would be. And, you know, Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth are both like early photo theorists. They wrote and thought a lot about photography. And Douglass said, you know, picture makers show the world as it could be and endeavor to remove the contradiction. And that's powerful.
I'm wondering if there are modern day images that stand out to you as something that's going to stand the test of time. For me, when we were talking about this earlier with our team, I immediately think of the taking a stand in Baton Rouge, the image that depicts a calm, strong young black woman facing a line of riot gear clad police officers.
Mm-hmm.
Are there specific images that speak to you from our current day?
Oh, you really nailed it. That one is so perfect. And part of what we love about that image is that it recalls earlier imagery. Like the photographers of the abolitionist era were starting with a new medium. They didn't have this long prehistory. We now can use allusions from earlier imagery. I saw an image the other day that looked just like Migrant Mother. And we see pictures all the time from Yemen, from the border, that are essentially our today's poster child. You know, that they are pictures that are intended to tell us something.
That is really interesting that the photograph or the picture you're talking about in the book, photography was a pretty new thing. It had only been around for 20 or so years at that time. And yet, almost instantly, people realized there was a real power here to push whatever story or agenda you wanted to.
Right, yeah. I asked my students the other day, you know, what is a technology that you think will be the same in 160 years. Like, can you think of a single technology that you're like, my car, my phone, whatever, that will be used in the same way, more or less? I mean, it's different in some
respects.
Radio,
we're keeping the needle moving.
Yes, let's hope so. Let's hope so. Yeah.
So kind of speaking of the media we're surrounded by these days, there's so much visual content we're exposed to. As a photographer, what do you think it's doing to us or doing for us? Kind of.
Ooh,
I know it's a tough question.
That is a tough one. I feel like as a photographer, I hope that photography has the power to show us something we don't want to see, as well as things it shows us what the other people's points of view are. I will say, though, that one of the things we struggle with is there's not enough photographers who are women and people of color whose work is being shown at the rate as white artists. And so we're not seeing all of that's possible from the camera yet.
All right. Well, that's Jessie Morgan Owens. She's the Dean of Studies at Bard Early College in New Orleans, Louisiana, and a photographer, also author of the new book, Girl in Black and White. Jessie, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Siderick, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. Saturday Night Live's A.D. Bryan is out with a new comedy on Hulu called Shrill. Critics are calling it The Quiet Revolution in the Portrayal of Fat Women on Television. The show features main character 27-year-old Annie on her journey of self-acceptance, love, and body positivity. But there are some bumps along the way, including a scene from the very first episode where a fitness trainer approaches her at a coffee shop.
Wow, your wrists are tiny.
Oh.
You actually have a really small frame. There is a small person inside of you dying to get out.
Oh, well, I hope that small person's okay in there.
Here with me to talk about Shrill and why it matters is culture critic and contributor to NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, Margaret Willison. Margaret, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So listeners, I do want to say the show takes up some serious topics, and there is a bit of language that might not be appropriate for all ages and ears, so please use your discretion. For people who maybe don't know much about this show, tell us a little bit about Shrill. What's it all about?
So it is a 6-episode sitcom. All the episodes are available on Hulu presently, so you can just binge straight through it. And it is a loose adaptation of essayist and critic Lindy West's memoir of the same name, which is sort of about how she found her voice in her 20s as both a fat woman and a culture critic, and how she came to understand the restraints that were placed on her and her body were actually one symptom of the restraints placed on all women in a patriarchal capitalist society. That sounds so fun.
That sounds very NPR. So this isn't obviously the first show to deal with women's bodies, weight shaming, body positivity, a lot of those themes. But a lot of the shows that have done that have been criticized for things like being inaccurate or deeply offensive. Do you think that this kind of rose above that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's so much verisimilitude to the stories that are presented here and so much authenticity to how the characters are interacting with the world. And then sort of even one step beyond that, what I think is really special about Shrill is so often when you have a show that's pretty early in the representation of a certain type of person or character on TV, there's this pressure to have them be absolutely perfect, right? There's this pressure that they're going to be this great, admirable character all of the time, and there isn't this freedom of space for them to screw up in the way actual human beings do. And Shrill manages to sidestep that, and it gives itself the freedom to show all of the garbage that Annie is pushing back against and how radical it is that she's finding her voice and using her voice the way that she is, and also the realistic way that at 28, when you've just come into this new understanding of the world and you've just come into this new understanding of yourself, you can end up being a little bit self-absorbed and you can lose sight of the relationships in your life that matter versus the relationships in your life that are distractions. And that it has the bravery to let her be a little crummy is so heartening to me.
You mentioned that it's based on Lindy West's 2016 memoir. West was actually talking with NPR about body image recently. I want to listen to a little bit of that.
The reality of being a fat person isn't that every moment of your life is about being fat. It's that you're trying to live the same kind of complicated, exciting, fun, beautiful, difficult life as everyone else. And then on top of it, you have this extra sort of external pressure from the world telling you that there's something wrong with you and that you should apologize for just living in your body.
She went on to say basically that it's not the main focus of the show. It's one component of many that Annie is dealing with. Do you think that the show accurately captures that, and why is that so important?
I absolutely think the show accurately captures that. I mean, I think it's so important for the reason that everybody says diversity of representation is important. It's like diversity of visible viewpoints just changes the way that we as human beings function in the world and understand the world. And for example, so one of the things I think the show does a really good job of dramatizing in terms of how being told that you're so overweight, you're sexually non-viable, how that plays out in women and how the fear of that endpoint controls women and impacts their relationships with other people is you get to watch Annie come into this realization that she is a beautiful woman, that she is an attractive woman, and that she has every right to have a good relationship.
Yeah, to that relationship point, I want to play a little tape here when Annie, who again played by Adie Bryant, who is brilliant in the show, by the way,
so good,
sits down with Ryan, who's played by Luka Jones. She's in this kind of casual, pretty demeaning relationship with him.
A real garbage monster.
He makes her leave through the back door, through the bushes, climbing over the fence, really undignified. So I just want to listen to a piece of the conversation when she starts to turn the corner a little bit.
I really, really thought about having a baby with you. And that you would have to take me out to restaurants and treat me like a normal girl. And then I just started thinking I shouldn't have to trap you into treating me like I'm a human being. And I've been letting people dismiss me or say to me about my body my entire life. And at this point, I just feel like them.
Yeah, them.
And you too.
Yeah, I mean.
Can you talk a little bit about that scene and that process of kind of coming to terms?
Yeah, I think one of the things that you see in this is when you think you're sexually non-viable, you see any sign of sexual interest as like, oh my God, it's the Holy Grail. Like, I finally reached the promised land and I have to do everything possible to make sure that I don't ruin this one chance I've got. And you can see that she is, over the course of this season, unlearning and relearning that story because she keeps pinging back and forth on this guy, Ryan. And I think one of the things that they do that's really strong is they give him permission to be like a little sweet. Like, he's not malicious. He's just sincerely an idiot.
Yeah. The phrase I think an NPR piece used was goober energy that comes out of him. I'm curious, though, as I was talking about this with Eve, the producer who worked on this segment with me, it was a conversation about why she's still with him.
Yeah. I think it's really strong that they let her be with him and they let you ask that question, like, what are you doing? And that you see her have all of these sort of micro revelations, because as a woman, and as a woman pretty much of any size, if you date men, you're told that, like, a man wanting to change for you is just – that's the brass ring. Like, and if you've got one that's willing to change for you, you hang on there, you stick in with him while he does that, no matter how low the bar you're setting for him is. Right? It's like, if he's just willing, you've laid the bar on the ground. If he's willing to step over it, you're like, oh, I've got one of the good ones. Gotta hold on here. And you can see that thinking happening with her, where he disappoints her and she's like, what are you doing? I'm too good to be in this. And then he expresses sincere apology and expresses that he wants to change. And you can see her just soften and collapse back into herself and say, oh, right. My job here isn't to realize my needs or recognize whether I'm being taken care of appropriately in this relationship. It's to facilitate change in this man now that he's deemed me worthy of changing for. And I have to stay here for this part of the project.
Wow. I want to ask about a scene that really struck a chord with me. And that's as she's kind of putting the pieces together that she's taken a lot of garbage from the people around her and that she doesn't necessarily need to. It's from the first episode, and she's talking with her best friend, Fran, who's played by Lolly Adefope.
Who's so good.
Let's take a listen to that.
When I was at my parents' house, and I was just looking at all these photos of me from when I was growing up, and little me was just so happy and fat and had big, dumb dreams. And I got myself into this huge mess, but I made a decision. Only for me, and I got myself out of it.
Good.
I don't know, I feel very powerful right now.
So, and we're talking about Shrill, loosely based on Lindy West's 2016 memoir of the same name. Margaret Willison, tell us a little bit about that scene. And 'cause what really struck for me was this idea of, as kids, we don't necessarily think about that until society makes us.
Right. The slow process of going from being told you can do anything, you can be anything, to realizing what people who look like you actually do get to do in the world. And this is something that Lindy West writes about hilariously and movingly in the book, of just like who her fat role models were as a kid. And it was like Miss Piggy and like Madam Cluck from Robin Hood and Ursula the Sea Witch and all of the things that she never saw anyone like her do. And no one ever tells you, no, that's impossible, or few people do, but you just don't see it and you absorb, oh, if I'm this way, if I'm fat, if I'm a woman, if I'm not a white man, then that's not available for me. But another thing that I think is really interesting in this scene and that I want to call out for the strength of the show is, like, we've talked a lot about Annie's journey and it's obviously the focus of the show. But one of the things that's really interesting is the show never lets that be the only story that's going on.
Right.
And in her relationships with her best friend, Fran, who we just heard in that clip, and with the guy she calls her work husband, Amadi, you get to see her failing
really badly as a friend, failing to be present for the people in her life and failing to recognize that while she's so absorbed in these two men who are, she's made the arbiters of her self-worth, Ryan, her garbage monster semi-boyfriend, and Gabe, her ex-punk semi-feminist gay boss, she's ignoring the relationships where people already love her, where they already value her. And she's treating the people who've already said, you're really important. She's treating them really badly.
I'm totally going to steal Garbage Monster from you, by the way. That's Margaret Willison, pop culture critic and contributor to NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Margaret, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zukoff, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with help today from Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. We also had help today from Kainat Khan. I'm Chris Sidorick. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.